A lot of you have been seeing me standing up here because this is the 12th module that we've done, some of us together, even though it's the 11th module in the order that FPMT presents them. So if you've been coming to Discovering Buddhism classes, you'll know this is a new module. It's the first night. That means you get an info sheet on the back with all of the readings and all of the places to get all of the readings and things like that you need. If you want to use this to track your progress, you can do that. And some people are tracking their progress to the extent where they will get credit for their progress. And since we're a little bit into the Discovering Buddhism series, just please, if you have any questions about any of that, see me afterwards and we can talk about that. And the regular teacher for this module is going to be Stephanie Smith, sitting there in the front row. But we have a special visiting teacher for this evening, which we are really excited about. So some of you are here for that reason as well. Next week, we don't have a regular Discovering Buddhism class, but it is a holy day, the day we celebrate Buddha's first teaching or the turning of the wheel. So if you can come to the center at all that day, that's wonderful. If you come this time next week, there'll be a puja, so that is a wonderful thing to attend. If you've attended any Discovering Buddhism in this whole cycle, please, please mark your calendars for October 22nd because we really want to celebrate any effort that we've put into this this Discovering Buddhism work, which lays the foundation of all the Lam Rim and then any work we're going to do in the future. But we'll stop and celebrate for a moment before we begin a whole nother cycle next January. And we offer, there's information on the info sheet about making donations because we offer these teachings without cost, but we happily take donations. If you have any logistical questions, you can ask me afterwards, and we'll continue this DB class 2 weeks from tonight with Stephanie.
Terrific. Thank you, Erin, and thank you, Stephanie. So those of you who don't know me, my name is Don Handrick. I've had the pleasure of being here for the weekend, and tonight's my last night here before I leave for Florida to teach down there for 3 weeks. Where Venerable Tendrin is, many of you know Venerable Tendrin, who used to be up here at Kadampa Center. So let's start today. Say hi. She actually won't be there. That's why I'm going down there, is that she's going to be away for the entire month of July. So they invited me down there to kind of fill her shoes. So I hope I can do it justice. So let's go to page 98. Many of you who've been coming to Discovering Buddhism know this verse that we recite. We'll just do this in English 3 times. It's called Refuge in Bodhicitta Before the Teaching. Again, if you're not familiar with this, refuge is a central concept that we want to find some sort of confidence in the Buddha's teachings to whatever degree we have. And many of you might be quite new to Buddha's teachings, so you can simply generate whatever confidence in the teachings that you have heard about, teachings on compassion and so on. And then the second part of it, bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is, of course, this motivation that we want to have ideally for these teachings. And we're going to do a short reflection on that just after we recite this prayer. But essentially it means that we're making that strong aspiration to work on ourselves to the greatest degree. As I was mentioning, these holy objects sort of represent the potential that each of us possesses to become fully enlightened, to become awakened. And so we're going to kind of generate that aspiration that we're able to accomplish that so that we can benefit all beings. So let's recite this verse 3 times together in English. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. You can set the prayer books aside and we'll just do a short meditation. And I don't want to spend too much time in meditation, so we have a bit of time for a teaching. But just find a good meditation posture. And by that I mean one where the back is relatively straight. There's an uprightness to the body. But also relax into this posture. You can close your eyes if you wish. Otherwise, just keep the eyelids slightly open. And begin to pay attention to the breath. And if you have a technique you already use to meditate on the breath, then you can do that. And if not, I generally suggest working with this point at the tip of the nose. As you breathe in and out through the nostrils, there's a very subtle sensation that occurs just inside the tip of the nose, sometimes even on the upper lip. But wherever you feel the sensation of the air coming in and out, try to stay with that sensation. Try not to let the mind wander. But no doubt we will get distracted at times. And when that happens, then there's no judgment. We simply let go of whatever it was that distracted us and gently return back to the breath. So let's do a few minutes of silent meditation on the breath. I'll ring the chime to start this period, and then I'll lead you in a short reflection to set this motivation of bodhicitta. Now, with our minds a bit more focused, let's generate our motivation for being here tonight. And as a way of briefly reviewing the Lam Rim, the stages of the path, especially for those of you who may not be familiar with that concept, we can see that it's structured in terms of three levels of motivation. So we're going to work with each of these individually just briefly. The starting point is to recognize that we have this incredible opportunity with this human life that we possess. Our human intellect is capable of investigating the teachings, capable of creating the causes for happiness, abandoning the causes for suffering. At the very first level of the three levels of the stages of the path, we first recognize that this life is fleeting, transitory. It will come to an end, without a doubt, for every one of us, though we do not know when. And when it ends, we will be under the control of various factors that will propel us into our next life. Our consciousness will go on. This is not the only life we have. Certainly is not the only life we have had. And in our next life, we could experience states where we don't have the luxury, the freedom that we currently possess in this human life. So the very first level of the stages of the path is to want that for oneself, to want to continue to have good rebirths, and then to make a dedicated effort to take refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and in particular to follow the law of karma, cause and effect, to understand that you yourself can create the causes for your next rebirth to be good, to be as good as this one, if not even better, in terms of the conditions that you have to use this life well, to develop yourself spiritually. The second level of motivation is where we look beyond just the next life and recognize that we've been on this wheel of existence for countless years, countless eons. In fact, there's no beginning to the lives that we've had in what we call samsara, this conditioned existence. But there's a way out. The Buddha taught very clearly that if we remove the causes of why we're in that cycle of existence, we will no longer be in it. We will be able to attain nirvana, the state of peace. So the level of motivation we bring now, the second step, is to really want to taste that freedom, that liberation, to know the peace that comes when we have removed all the causes of suffering, all of our own distorted states of mind, disempowered all the karma that keeps us going from life to life. So generate just some feeling of that as well, turning your mind towards that goal of your own liberation, your own freedom from all dissatisfaction, all suffering. And then we arrive at the third level, where we go beyond just self-concern. In the first two levels, we were looking at our own situation, our own rebirth that we want to be favorable, our own liberation from this cycle of existence. We're not alone in our predicament. Every single person in this room, every single being in this state, in this country, in this world, every single being in whatever realm of existence there is, every single being is just like us, wanting to be happy, wanting to not suffer, and having the potential to achieve that freedom from suffering, that true happiness and peace. So here we generate the mind that is dedicated to the welfare of all of those beings, thinking, I'm here not just for my own purpose, but to help all beings to know the taste of liberation, enlightenment. And I'm going to do this by striving to become a Buddha myself, striving to fully enlightened. Because in the state of full enlightenment, I can then have everything I need to benefit others. It's especially important that we generate that mind of bodhicitta, that mind of awakening, mind of enlightenment, for these teachings in particular, since these are very much a part of that path of awakening to full enlightenment. So just try to generate this open-heartedness, embracing all beings in the scope of your motivation for being here tonight. Okay. So the name of this module that I'm going to kind of get started tonight for all of you who are doing Discovering Buddhism, and also give a little talk on one aspect of this module, is called Transforming Problems into Happiness. So I would guess that most of us know what it's like to have problems. Does anybody in the room not have problems? No? Okay. So this is our situation, right? We have these things that we call problems, difficulties. We're going to examine in particular some things tonight that we kind of have in our world that every one of us experiences to some degree. The habitual way of dealing with problems is to see them as such and to simply create the causes for more problems, because we don't respond in a really kind of wholesome and healthy way to these problems. This whole corpus of teachings that we're going to be examining in this model, what's called this transforming problems, this idea of taking adversities, difficulties, and making them into something that supports our happiness and well-being. This is all part of the larger corpus of teachings that are called Lojong in Tibetan. I just want to introduce this concept. You'll probably hear more about it as you go through the module. These two words, Lojong, Lo has the connotation of mind or consciousness, and then Jong means training or transformation. And we can say everything the Buddha taught is about mind training or mind transformation, right? You know, we're not about, Buddhism isn't about transforming the outside world and making everything perfect out there. It's about making everything perfect in here. In fact, the Tibetan word for Buddhist is Nangpa. It simply means inner being, somebody who's doing the work inside, internally, meaning in our minds. And by mind or consciousness, we mean that element of our experience that is clear and non-material, and that which knows, it perceives. And it's there all the time, moment after moment of what we call consciousness or mind. And as I mentioned in the motivation, every moment of mind has arisen from a previous mind, so our lives go back without any beginning, and our consciousness goes forward without any end. Now, where it goes to, of course, as I mentioned, we have great control over once we become aware of that. But eventually, it will go to enlightenment, and this is why these teachings are taught, is so that we can achieve the full potential of our mind. So we could say mind training is everything the Buddha taught. The Buddha, that's his expertise. But nonetheless, this particular corpus of teachings that we call Lojong or mind training are a specific body of teachings that derive from the Buddha sutras, but were taught about 1,000 years ago by a great Lama, Lama Atisha, who came to Tibet from India, and he brought with him like the full corpus of all these teachings that we call the Mahayana tradition, the path to enlightenment, Buddhahood. He's the one who started the stages of the past teachings that we follow here. And he brought in particular some verses and ideas around Lojong or mind training that are really quite revolutionary. Understand that this is kind of pretty high-level practice we're going to be talking about tonight, because it is not just what ordinary people will sign up for. You know, the idea of being able to embrace your problems and make them a part of your spiritual path. Most people want to shut out their problems. They want to get rid of their problems. The Buddhist path is one that will eventually lead to not having any problems. But we all have problems in our lives, so how do we use them skillfully? So one of the core teachings of Lojong is this idea of transforming problems. So what I'd like to talk about tonight as a way of kind of getting into this discussion of what we mean by problems, or what we mean by even happiness in this worldly life, is to understand that, first of all, we all have kind of both experiences within every day of our lives, I would say. We have what we call kind of those things that bring us happiness, that are easy for us, that we enjoy, and then we have the things that bring us misery. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, I'm going to pull this up here in a moment, in one book that he wrote on some mind training verses, went back to the beginning. Let me see if I can pull it down to where I need to go. It's not going where I want it to. Let me paraphrase rather than spending time playing with my tablet here. His Holiness essentially says that there are kind of two times in our lives where we might find it really difficult to practice. The first time is actually when things are going quite well. Why? Because then we become very complacent. You know, we think, oh, I must be getting it all right, right? Everything is going really, really well. Everything's wonderful, hunky-dory, you know, everything's peachy, whatever phrase you use. We, you know, this can be kind of a, can't necessarily stop our practice, but it definitely slows it down. It impedes it to a large degree. Because when we think everything is going fine, well, then there doesn't seem like there's any need to practice. But then when things start going bad, what happens then? We're frequently just so overtaken and discouraged by what's happening that we forget to practice the teachings, that we neglect to practice the teachings. And in the process of that, we just simply exacerbate our own suffering by continuing to do what we habitually have done in regard to problems. So when we talk about these two things that are kind of the poles of our existence, it's a bit of why we talk about bipolar, right? You know, we're all bipolar, as Venerable Rabina says, it's just degrees. So we all have these kind of going back and forth between our highs and our lows, and we're frequently forgetting to practice at either of those times. Let's talk about what those times are like in terms of a teaching that's called the eight worldly dharmas, or the eight worldly concerns. So the eight worldly concerns encapsulate the major times when we are really getting kind of distracted by everything going well and quite attached to it and intoxicated by it even. And then we're also getting really bummed out and depressed and anxious when things aren't going well. And they're set out in four pairs, which is really kind of a nice way to look at things, is to understand that we do have things that we're drawn towards, that we want to experience, that we get very graspy about. And then we have their opposites that are when we don't get that, when we have those kind of negative experiences, and therefore we don't create any positive things at that time. So we're quite attached to both of these things happening, to, first of all, getting what we want, and then not getting what we don't want. And so we're going to put them out in those pairs. So the very first pair has to do with the fact that we're very much attached to getting material gain, getting things in our lives. This is why advertising exists in the world, right? Because we all like having things. We all like gain. I mean, compare what we talk about here on this side of getting what we want in terms of gain to not getting what we want in terms of loss. And we know what we feel like when we lose money. And an example might be even when you go to your mailbox and you see that there's a check in there that you didn't expect. You feel really good, right? Kind of, oh my gosh, unexpected money. You feel kind of a bit graspy at that, like, what can I possibly do with that? And then you go to the mailbox on another day and there's a bill that you didn't remember that you came in, and all of a sudden you realize that you're going to be losing some of the money in your bank because you've got to pay that bill. So we know that even at this simple level of kind of watching our finances, we can see that we're really averse to any type of loss, any type of unexpected, you know, drain on our resources, and we're also quite attached to having gain, having things come in, having things be pleasing in that way. This is the pattern that we're going to see with all four sets of these, is that there's something that we feel really drawn to having and even kind of grasp at having, and then on the basis of that grasping to having it in that way, we then experience an inversion at that point when we have the opposite. So when we get lost in our lives, we have strong reactions that are very negative. These are the times, as His Holiness says, that we find it hard to practice. Instead, we get really bent out of shape and, you know, we get depressed and we do things that are not so healthy and wholesome. So this is the first pair, is kind of understanding that we have this strong reaction to kind of the material things in our lives. Again, very much a part of the Western world to a great degree. But I mean, these were taught centuries ago, so don't think that this is just a phenomenon in the United States or in the West. This is something that people have always dealt with, is the reality of being attached to getting things and not wanting to lose those things, not wanting to lose the possessions they possess. The second set of these is where we get quite attached to what we would call comfortable, pleasant experiences, right? And we're quite averse to the uncomfortable, unpleasant experiences. This is one of the hardest ones, and it's something that pervades a good part of our day, is always wanting to stay comfortable, right? I kind of joke about this, and now that I'm on the road and I do a lot of flying, you know, I've come to the realization that I don't think there's anybody, unless you're traveling with someone else, there's nobody that reserves the middle seat in advance, right? Does anybody in the room reserve the middle seat in advance if you're traveling alone, right? We know because it's not so comfortable, right? You're sitting there and the people on either side have their elbows and it's just not the greatest place to be. So, it's a real small example of the clinging we have to being comfortable. I think Venerable Rabina told me once, she says that's the hardest one for her. I think it's the hardest one for a lot of us. And we might be able to kind of deal with a little bit of material loss, but you know, to be uncomfortable, to not have things in that space, even just look at what we deal with in terms of temperatures, in terms of, you know, the room needing to be comfortable. And for half of you in the room, it's probably not comfortable right now. The other half, it's comfortable. That's another thing that's kind of playing in here that we're going to talk about a bit tonight, is the relativity of all of this, that there's nothing absolute about any of these things. It's what we find to be comfortable that we get quite attached to. And then we like it our way. And we kind of want to have it our way and even get bent out of shape when we're uncomfortable, when we don't have it the way that we like. As I said, when we're kind of following these eight worldly concerns, we sort of forget to practice real dharma. They call these eight worldly dharmas at times even. But by dharma there, we don't mean the dharma that's the Buddha's teachings. We mean just a dharma of a thing that we engage in, a phenomenon. So these worldly concerns or worldly dharmas, we can get totally captivated in and spend our whole day going after being comfortable, going after having everything right, having the temperature right, the food right, the temperature of the food right. You know, everything that we meet, we get into such, you know, clinging around, needing to have it all perfect. And we get so bent out of shape when things aren't that way. And we can see, and many of you, as you listen to these teachings tonight, you might go, yeah, I know people like that. The goal is not to say, I know people like that. Though if you do recognize it in others, I guess it's showing, you know, that you can pinpoint it. The goal is mostly to use whatever you see in others as a mirror to see it in yourself and to really recognize how this is operative in your own life, the extent to which you go after needing that comfortable experience, needing that material gain, those things in your lives, being really averse to any discomfort, any loss. So these are the first two sets, which I think are operative to a larger degree than the other two sets. And nonetheless, each of us have our own predispositions, and certainly the next pair does play a role for many of us. And that's our attachment, our craving for praise, for people to say good things about us. Right? We don't like, on the other hand, and have a strong aversion towards people saying things that are critical of us. Anything that denigrates us, anything that is pointing out any of our faults. You know, we have these, again, polar things that we're totally attached to getting and then totally averse to receiving. Okay, so this one, again, as I said, it's not that it's absent from our lives at all. I think the first two play a more prominent role. Maybe I've got a bias for myself. But nonetheless, this is something that we very much, you know, react to from a pretty young age. And kids are a good example of it, right? You know, you start getting critical with kids and or teenagers in particular, you know, and you're in for it. And they really like to be praised. You know, and praise in and of itself, this is the one thing I'm going to emphasize as we go through this, it's not to say that praise is a bad thing. You know, and praise can be helpful in our lives to be praised ourselves for what we've done, to praise others. It's the attachment to all of that, the craving, the grasping for all of that. So this word attachment that I'm going to be using throughout this discussion is a distorted state of mind. It's a state of mind where we are looking at everything that's in this first column, that is the good, wonderful things of material gain and comfort and praise, and then we'll go on to the last one. And it's seeing those as kind of inherently capable of making us completely happy, completely filled with nothing but happiness in and of themselves, and then pulling them towards ourselves and not wanting to be parted from them. You know, we want to keep in that comfortable space. We want to hear those, you know, words of praise continually. We want to continue to have the checks coming in and all the good stuff in our lives. And we don't want to experience the opposite. This is a mind that we could say is an attachment to not experiencing that, but we usually call that an aversion, or even sometimes it becomes more elevated into more negative states of mind that could be quite harmful, not just for ourselves, but for others. So these are distorted states of mind with regard to what we're experiencing throughout our day, because every one of us through the course of our day is going to experience comfort, is going to experience discomfort, is going to experience getting things and not getting things. It's going to experience praise and criticism to some degree. So this is an operative one, certainly for many of us. The fourth level is a very subtle one that does play a pretty prominent role in a lot of our lives. And this is where we have a strong attachment to having a good reputation, having people think well of us. You know, we really like to be liked. You know, we want that kind of good feeling that others like us, appreciate us, that they think well of us. And we don't like having, you know, the bad rep. We don't like having people see us as somebody who's unpleasant, somebody who they don't like. We need sort of a healthy reputation. Sometimes they even call these sort of, you know, fame and ill repute. I don't think most of us are, like, after our 15 minutes of fame, as Andy Warhol said, you know, maybe we're not out to become rock and roll stars or something. But we like having a good rep. We like people thinking well of us in general. So that's kind of an extension to some degree of having praise, but it's praise in a more general way, in that we do like to be thought of well in our communities, in our families, at our work. We want to have that kind of good reputation. You don't want to be known as sort of the crabby person at work or the awful person that nobody wants to talk to. So we get quite attached to that pair as well. So what we see fundamentally operating at this level of examining these four pairs, is that the common thing through them is this idea of desire or attachment. And this is, of course, when the Buddha first taught on the Four Noble Truths, when he began to explain our state of existence, why we are suffering, and so on. He essentially said that we're suffering because we desire, because we crave, because we grasp at things. So this is not just our ordinary wanting things, because at some level we can say that the foundation for all the Buddha's teachings is that sentient beings, beings like ourselves, want to be happy and don't want to suffer. And if there was something wrong with that, the Buddha would have certainly said it. He never said, this is a problem that you want to be happy and you don't want to suffer. It's that we get quite attached to that idea. In particular, in this transitory world where we have all this external stuff happening and we go grasping at wanting to get that and pushing away that with some sense of, you know, concreteness to these two things, and not really recognizing that we can have a different attitude with regard to those. I'm going to read a little bit from a book. It's not the book, main book that you'll be using here in this course. That book is by Lama Zopa Rinpoche as well, who's our spiritual director. He's on the right-hand side of His Holiness in the picture up there. This was a book by Lama Zopa Rinpoche called The Door to Satisfaction, which is also in the bookshop, probably in the library as well. And it's a really wonderful book in terms of exploring a lot of these same ideas. So what he's essentially saying is, when it comes down to it with regard to these eight, he says it's easy to understand how it can be a problem not to acquire things, to be unhappy, you know, to be praised, to be criticized, to have a bad reputation, and so on. These are commonly recognized as problems, but you might not recognize acquiring things, having comfort and happiness, you know, hearing praise, having a good reputation as problems. However, they are all the same. They are all problems. But the object itself is not the problem. This is the point I'm making, is that we can't say that comfort and discomfort are the problem, or that praise and, you know, criticism are the problem. The problem is the mind desiring and clinging to wealth. That is the problem. Having a friend is not the problem. The mind clinging to the friend makes having a friend a problem. So essentially, desire makes having these four, you know, and avoiding the other four a problem. If there's no desire, no attachment, no worldly concern, having or not having these objects does not become a problem. So this is where we get into this whole idea, really, of mind training and what it's really about. Because at the deepest level, what we have to see is that those things that we are identifying problems, which are the four that are over here, which are when we're getting something we don't want, or we're not getting what we want, that those are totally identified as such by our own minds. We are the ones that are dictating whether those are problems or not. We are the ones that are determining that not getting those four things are problems for us. That's how we are framing them. And what we're going to see in particular with regard to those four is that they can actually be very useful tools on our path. There are actually amazing positive qualities about those four. There are actually amazing opportunities with working with not getting what you want. On the other hand, the four that are getting what you want, as Rinpoche points out, those are where we're following desire as well, our desire to have those things in our lives. And we need to be looser around those. We're not going to talk about transforming those into the path quite as much. But nonetheless, we know that we can't continue to go craving and grasping at all of that stuff because it simply accentuates the problems that we have over here when we don't get those things. So this technique of transforming our problems or our difficulties into the path or into happiness means that we're going to let go of our habitual response to these things. We're going to transform our minds, train our minds to not have such clinging and grasping at those four that are the four positive things, if you will, or things that induce some pleasurable feeling for us, and not have such a negative response of aversion and anger and so on to the four that are the opposite of that. Of course, and you know, I would learn this from, not in Buddhism necessarily, but even early on that, I don't know who it was that taught it to me, maybe it was my parents, but the idea of seeing a problem as an opportunity. I think there even is some colloquial thing that in Chinese characters, the word for danger is the same as, or the character for danger is the same as opportunity. And this is something that we can actually come to understand, is that when we do have difficulties in our lives, they can actually be very, very rich opportunities for us. So everything here, as I said, is really quite relative. It's relative to what we are doing with our minds in terms of how those experiences are going to be used. Are they going to be used as something favorable and positive in our lives, or are we going to continue to have the patterns that make them into problems, into difficulties in our lives? I was talking earlier about how a lot of this stuff is really quite relative, because if I put together my list, if I've got my four worldly concerns over here that drive me, what I like to get in my lives, my life, the things that I like to possess, the comfortable situations I like to be in, the things I need for my comfort, all of that. If I put together my list, it's not going to be the same as all of your list, right? Because you find particular things that are comfortable for you, or that please your own desire for wealth or praise or whatever the case might be. And that's because, once more, we each have kind of those things that we're kind of conditioned to experience in that way. But that idea even speaks to the relativity of this, that there's nothing fixed about those things. I pointed this out over the weekend. I think it was the weekend. I'm not sure. Maybe I didn't teach it here. When I'm on the road, I sometimes forget where I've taught things. But if we take anything that brings you some measure of pleasure and comfort in your life, and I like to use the example of music. If we take, some your favorite music and think about your own favorite music right now, and no doubt, many of us in the room are thinking about different types of music, right? Because we know that music is something that each one has. We each have our own tastes. And even in our lives, we have different times when we like different types of music. Think about the music you liked when you were a teenager. Think about the music you liked when you were quite young. So we know that there's things that we feel kind of very much drawn towards, but there's nothing kind of within that music that makes it pleasurable. Our pleasure is dictated by our own response to that, how we relate to that. So when we go chasing after all these things that bring us pleasure, we're already somewhat blind to the fact that there's nothing kind of there from the side of that object that inherently brings us that pleasure, that brings us that pleasure in some kind of lasting way. Because as I said, even the music that you liked when you were in, your teenage years is different than the music you like now. And if you put on some of that, you go, tired of that music. I don't really care for that anymore, right? So we know that there's nothing kind of there that is dictating that. So what's dictating that is ourselves, our own minds, our own sort of response to those things in our lives. As I said, these are all quite relative. Another example to kind of loosen up our feeling around what those objects represent for us and sort of the experience that we have on the basis of them is the idea of how even things are relative in terms of what is comfortable and what is not comfortable, for example. I mean, I see people putting on a jacket now that the air conditioning's on. So this is a really good example, right? You know, so in your home, if you have, you know, your air conditioning in the summer, you might set it for some temperature. I mean, let's just use 75 as an example, okay? So you set your house for 75. And when you come in from the hot day, it feels really nice to go into the cool of 75, right? And you know that if you had it set for something like 60 or something, that you would actually, you know, feel that that's freezing, that that's too cold. But nonetheless, if you go outside and it's cold and it's the middle of winter and you come into the house and your thermostat is set at 60, it actually would feel pretty warm for the time being. It might not feel that cold initially. And then you turn it up to 75 and maybe that even starts to feel too hot. So we see that these temperatures that we call cool or warm, everything is quite relative. There's nothing sort of fixed about any of these. So whenever we're kind of grasping at being attached to these experiences that bring us pleasure, these four worldly concerns that are on that side of the equation, we're not sort of recognizing that there's something about them that is purely our own subjective assessment of those. It's our own judgment of those, whether that's good music, whether this is a comfortable temperature, whether this is what I like, whether this is, you know, something I enjoy hearing. All of these things are dictated from our own side. And the goal in examining things this way is to just begin to loosen up a bit of our attachment to that. As I said, this whole technique of working with the other side of it that we're going to focus on in this module of transforming when we get the four unpleasant things, when we have these problems, the goal is to undermine all of the habitual states of mind that we've had. The strong aversion to those problems, the inability to withstand any form of suffering or difficulty. So we can do it on this other side too. It's why I'm spending a little bit of time, because tonight I want to focus on this idea of the four worldly concerns that are pleasurable and the four that are unpleasurable, and I want to make sure we don't totally discard the four that are pleasurable, because there's something to work with there too. Something to loosen up our minds around as well on that side of the equation, to recognize that our strong attachment, as I said, becomes the force by which we have a strong aversion over here. Because when we're so attached to having it our way over here, which is really just our way, as we're pointing out in this examination of these things, it's really something that we subjectively are determining is good music, is a comfortable temperature, is, you know, good things to hear. When we make that decision from our side over here and get attached to it being that way, then we get bent out of shape when it's over here, when we aren't getting what we want. So when we aren't getting what we want, of course, this is what this whole module is about, is saying, what do we do with our minds in the face of not getting what we want? Lama Zopa Rinpoche, as you'll see throughout this module, and if you read the book that accompanies this module, Transforming Problems into Happiness, he essentially says that we have to develop two kind of states of mind that'll help us to, that'll eventually take us to the place where that we ideally want to be. The first is to not having such a strong aversion to experiencing what is negative. Okay. That's a hard one for us to hear initially too, because this is in the unpleasant category, admittedly. These are things that we don't like to hear. So if you really like kind of, soft and beautiful, soothing music, and then you hear something that's a bit loud and abrasive, well then, you know, this is inducing an unpleasant feeling for you. Some people have loud and abrasive over here, though, right? That's their pleasant sound. They really enjoy loud and abrasive music as they're going down the street in their car. You know, so we are making a subjective judgment and having an aversion to that. I'm using these examples that are, again, a bit worldly, but nonetheless, you know, we have a whole score of things that happen on this side that we call problems or difficulties. But when you encounter something that is like that for you, the loud and abrasive music, if you like the soft, calm music, well, then we see that we are kind of having that strong aversion at that time. We don't want to experience that. And Rinpoche's advice for the first way that we work with this and kind of where we need to go with our practice is to not have such a strong aversion to what we call suffering, what we call something that is sort of unpleasant. Because that immediately kind of puts a block to doing anything else with it, and it causes a pattern of annoyance and irritation and anger and hatred and malice. I mean, all these like escalating thoughts to where you're like, you know, especially if this is a neighbor who's playing this music when you're trying to meditate or trying to enjoy your, you know, a good book or something. You're sitting there and you're trying to enjoy a Sunday afternoon, and all of a sudden you got boom, 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 boom. And you know, your mind just starts going in that corner. You know, it keeps escalating. It's like, okay, I'm just going to get tighter and tighter. And you get so wound up that you're ready to go over there and like hit the guy in the face or something. Maybe do worse. Let's hope not. But, you know, so we see that our aversion to that unpleasant thing at that time is the starting point for a whole bunch of problems. You know, and we felt pretty justified in doing that. We feel like, you know, well, the guy was doing what he was doing to interrupt my peace of mind. But we don't recognize it at that time. There's an incredible opportunity. An opportunity for us to work with our minds in the face of not getting what we want. You know, having something that isn't so comfortable, that isn't so pleasant. Yeah. So the whole module we'll be looking at the ways that we sort of transform those situations. But this first idea that Rinpoche is putting out is that we have to stop having such a strong aversion to not getting what we want, to having those unpleasant things in our lives. Yes? What's your name?
Sorry. Oh, that's Jared.
Okay. Jared.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, wait for the microphone.
Hey, sorry, I feel weird to ask, but I feel like it's not question time or whatever.
Okay.
Like, I'm wondering about it so much, so it feels to me like as a human being, like the whole idea is very, I understand what you're saying, but at the same time it's like, okay, if the answer to not, you know, reacting, to have such strong aversions,
okay,
and negative reactions to such aversions, if the antidote to that is to not have such strong attachments on the other side,
mm-hmm,
yet at the same time we're human.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I, what if I want to be able to go to the beach and enjoy it?
Right.
But it's like, it's almost like saying, well, the more you enjoy being on the beach,
mm-hmm,
the more you're going to have a negative reaction to aversion. So
right,
it's kind of, you know, it's a real dilemma to me. Like, I want to have like a, more of an equanimity and not have such a negative,
sure,
reaction to aversions,
yeah,
and I understand that, you know, the attachment aspect of that and how it relates.
Right.
To me, it's like, you know, well, what's the solution to that? Like, you know, the first thing that pops in mind is like, well, what, can I not enjoy going to the beach? Or do I have to try to enjoy it less to have less of an aversion or less of a negative reaction to aversion? So it's just, you know, I'm interested to learn, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, I appreciate you bringing that up because the words that you used were kind of interesting because you said, you know, should not enjoy going to the beach. I would say, actually, if you don't have attachment to going to the beach, you enjoy going to the beach more. Because what we are doing with the mind of attachment that's over on that side of the equation when we have a comfortable experience, a pleasant experience, is that we don't want to be separated from it, that we even get bent out of shape. Like, say you're on the beach and you're really enjoying the sun and the water and everything, and then the clouds come over and all of a sudden you're not enjoying being at the beach anymore. And you get really bent out of shape because you were quite attached to having all the conditions that made being at the beach fun. So what I'm talking about is our reaction to getting what is pleasant or getting what is unpleasant. It's not the pleasant experience or the unpleasant experience itself. And if we are able to keep a mind that is, as you said, in a bit more equanimity around of it, not so bent out of shape when we don't get what we want, when the sun goes away and being at the beach isn't fun any longer, then we will be able to have a more peaceful mind that actually, in my estimation, would be able to not necessarily enjoy the unpleasantness, but not be so bent out of shape when the unpleasantness happens. So the enjoyment, the actual enjoyment, the pleasurable experience, and really essentially what we're talking about, let me kind of pull this back a little bit into some of the teachings that are set out in the study of the mind in Buddhism. There is a factor in our minds, it's called feeling, the factor of feeling, this mental factor. It's essentially more like a feeling tone, I like to use that word. And you have three different feeling tones that can be registered at any time in your life, any moment in your life. One is going to be a pleasant feeling tone. We all know that one, right? But we also know the unpleasant feeling tone. Yeah, the pleasant tone for the person who likes the joy of the calm, beautiful music, that's kind of the feeling that they get from that. The unpleasant feeling tone is what they get from something that's a bit abrasive that they don't enjoy listening to. Then you have a neutral feeling, and neutral feelings are just those times in our day when we're sort of flatlining. There's not a whole lot being registered one way or another. You know, it's not that we're uncomfortable and having an unpleasant feeling, and it's not that we're really quite, you know, pleasant and enjoying the moment and whatever. So these are all that is happening to us at these moments. When we hear the music we really enjoy, we get a pleasant feeling. Everything else on top of that is a fabrication in terms of the attachment that develops on the basis of getting that pleasant feeling. If we were able to divorce ourselves from all of that stuff and not have that whole storyline going about that pleasant sensation, it's said that we could actually enjoy that pleasant sensation even more, because we're not overlaying it with all kinds of crazy stuff. Because the crazy stuff is what makes us bent out of shape when the pleasant thing stops, when the unpleasant occurs. And all that's happening over here, essentially, is an unpleasant feeling. And we get bent out of shape because we create a whole storyline around it. We build it up into so much more than what is really happening. So when we take it down to the bare bones, this is all that's happening in our day. Everything else is a mental fabrication on top of experiencing one of these three feelings. Experiencing a pleasant feeling, an unpleasant feeling, a neutral feeling. And we make up a whole lot of stuff on the basis of that. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, we're somewhat conditioned to have those sorts of feelings because, as I said, when I play, if I came in and played a particular song, some of you in the room are going, ugh, that. And other people are going, oh, I really like that. So it's not the object that's doing that. It's how we are conditioned to have these sorts of experiences. So back to your point that you're making, does it mean that you can't enjoy going to the beach? Well, no, going to the beach has its pleasant moments within it. I would say it probably has its unpleasant moments, even if the clouds don't come over. There's times when it feels too hot in the sun and we jump into the water, and then it feels too cold in the water and we go back out to the sun. We have that kind of change in our experiences. But if we have a mind that is completely averse to experiencing the opposite of that because it's so attached to needing it that way, then we're inevitably going to have problems. We're going to have things that interrupt our peace, things that get us bent out of shape when the day at the beach doesn't go the way that we want it to go. So in my estimation, yeah, the enjoyment of the beach isn't the problem. It's the story we put on top of the enjoyment of the beach, just like the enjoyment of any of these objects that are on that list, the list of these four, isn't really the problem. Getting something does feel good. Being attached to it feels awful, because then when it falls and breaks or whatever, then we get really bent out of shape because we thought of it in a way that is contrary to how it actually exists. We held on to it as if it was going to be lasting and give us that kind of full satisfaction. And I'm sure we've all had these experiences, like going to the beach or going to your favorite place in town or whatever, and you had such anticipation and expectation that it was going to be the way you want it to be, and then it isn't. You know, there's like a lot of really loud, crazy people at the beach, or there's, you know, things that are happening that make it so like a bit unpleasant. You know, and so we set ourselves up for disappointment. We set ourselves up for things not being the way we want them to be because we're so attached to getting them the way we want them to be. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's not get into too many other questions and things, unless this really needs some clarification, because I don't really have too much more time. I've got about half hour left.
I'd like to ask you a Does that have anything to do with the nervous system or sensation?
Well, again, yeah, the Buddha didn't teach the nervous system, and so he's talking about mind and consciousness, which is integrated into this physical body. And this physical body has its own way of operating that scientists and biologists and physiologists have come to understand. But what we're talking about is what's registering on a mental sphere, not physically necessarily, though obviously a lot of the data we receive is through our bodies. We hear the music we like or the music we don't like, and we, you know, taste the things that we enjoy or that we don't enjoy. But then it's, once it's kind of through that portal of a physical experience, then it becomes the mental domain. And it's simply registering as a feeling tone. Oh, I like the taste of that. Ugh, that tastes horrible. And then it builds a whole story on that. It kind of fabricates something that is on top of that, that isn't really there. Because we just showed that it isn't really there, because otherwise everybody would like the taste of Brussels sprouts, right? Or everybody would enjoy rap music, or everybody would enjoy whatever. I mean, you know, we can't say that it's from the side of the object and that it's sort of inherently there and that we all see it that way, because we don't. And it's not. So instead we have these, yes, there's physical bodies involved in terms of bringing all this in, and our nervous system and all the other parts that I can't speak to that are operative that produce a mental experience. But we're talking about what happens when it is a mental experience, when it's in the mental domain, and all the stories we put around it. You know, as Rinpoche says, the object is not the problem. The material wealth, the you know, comfortable situation, pleasant situation, the praise, the good reputation, none of these things are the problem. It's our relationship to them in terms of the story that we tell about them, the grasping at them, the not wanting to be separated from them, the desire to hear them again, to experience them again. We get into all these habitual patterns that we just keep repeating. And as I was saying, the strength of those certainly dictates the strength of how much aversion we feel when we don't get those things. Does that make some sense, Jared? Or I'm sorry, what was your name again?
Jared.
Jared, yeah. Okay. So, all right. So let's take a look at, a little bit more at the second thing that Rinpoche says. The Rinpoche says, I'll find his words that I can quote here. Let me see if I can do that real quickly. I think they're in that one document that I was needing to page through, but maybe I can get it to work for me a little better now. There we go. All right. Okay, just about there. Sorry, hang on. Okay. I'm sorry, I had this all set up before I came in. You have to forgive me for that, but... Okay, where is Rinpoche's words on that? I'm sorry, I'm really not finding these. So, I'm going to paraphrase again. All right. So, essentially what Rinpoche says in the first one is we have to stop this thought of having aversion to those things that are difficult in our lives, those things that are what we call suffering or unpleasant experiences, anything that's in that list over here, these four. The second one is that we actually have to learn to reframe them as things that we want in our lives, that we enjoy in our lives. In fact, Rinpoche goes to the extent, this quote I do know of his, is that we should eventually get to the place where we like our problems in the same way that we like ice cream. Okay, so think about how you like ice cream, or if you don't like ice cream, then fill in whatever, you know, cheesecake, you know, whatever it is that floats your boat, you know, just put in that and say, I want to be able to like problems in my life as much as I currently like fill in the blank. That's a pretty tall order. The first one is a pretty tall order to begin with, to say, I'm going to sort of change my thinking so that I'm not having such a strong aversion to these things that come into my life that I call problems. Secondly, I'm going to learn to actually like them, actually enjoy them, actually look forward to them. Now, you might wonder, why on earth would I want to do that? Well, that's kind of the gist of these transforming problems, you know, exercises, why we engage in this type of practice, is because we actually recognize that within that practice of embracing and welcoming in problems is an opportunity to develop our minds to a degree that we cannot if we continue to have aversion to our problems. If we continue to kind of push everything out of our lives, we're missing that opportunity. We're not welcoming those things in as something that are like, sit down and show me what you have to teach me. Show me what I can learn from this. So experiencing something like enduring, you know, the difficult neighbor who's playing their loud music. And by the way, I don't want to make it sound like you have to sit there and never say anything to your neighbor about the loud music. But you'll say it to your neighbor with a very different mind if you've worked on this type of practice versus sitting there and stewing in it and eventually being ready, you know, red face full of rage, going over there and banging on their door and then doing something. If you work with welcoming in these problems and actually say, what do you have to teach me? What can I possibly develop from this? Then you will go about cultivating all the qualities that are talked about in this module, which are qualities that we know from just the world at large, not even Buddhist study, are useful to have. Qualities like patience, qualities like compassion, qualities like love, you know, tolerance, and so on. We can actually cultivate those positive states of mind when we're welcoming in, not having aversion, and even welcoming in these problems, these difficulties. And this is a tough thing to get. Again, it's not, this is high-level practice, you know. Venerable Urbina, when she teaches the Lam Rim, she says, you know, there's got kind of grade school, which is the first level, and then you've got the middle school, and then you have university. This is even almost like graduate studies. This is like something where we're taking not just these wonderful thoughts of love and compassion, but we're saying, how can I cultivate them in even the most difficult situations? And, you know, it's been interesting. In the last couple of months, I've had some exposure to some people in the world who've been able to do this, and not personally, but by reading their memoirs. There's a wonderful memoir called The Choice, Embrace the Possible, by a woman named Dr. Edith Eva Egger. She was a Holocaust survivor, and as a young Jewish girl from Hungary, at the age of 16, she was taken to the concentration camps. And in her memoir, she talks about the gift that that was for her. Not that it was easy at the time, not that she was looking at life in concentration camps as like ice cream. I don't think she was working with it at that level at that time. But she's been able, through the work that she's done since then, to transform that experience into something that made her a much richer, more compassionate person in the world. Another book that I just started reading, but I've heard a bit of his story, by a man named Anthony Ray Hinton. This book is called The Sun Does Shine. He was an African-American man in Alabama who was falsely convicted of a crime and spent 30 years on death row. 30 years on death row. I mean, think of where you were 30 years ago if you're over 30. Some of you in the room might not be over 30. Where were you 30 years ago? Imagine having spent from then until now in prison on death row for a crime you didn't do. Really, just because of the color of his skin. That was why he was, you know, sent to prison in that way. The story actually, by the way, goes that he was actually working in a locked factory at the time when the crime was committed. There was a guard there on duty that can attest to the fact that he was not there. And he was still convicted, you know. So imagine the anger that you could have after 30 years of that. But he came to the conclusion after even just 3 years of this stewing in his stuff on death row that he couldn't live this way, and that actually he could transform that into a path of compassion, a path of compassion for his fellow death row inmates. I mean, there's amazing stories out there, and why I point out some of these stories, these might not even be what we consider ordinary people because they've had extraordinary things happen in their lives. But nonetheless, we have things that happen in our lives, and are we capable of mustering up some of that same strength of courage, of willingness that some of these people were able to do. I think that's what we're being challenged to do in doing this type of study on transforming problems, is to say, how do I actually take that stuff that is pretty awful to experience? It's not pleasant in any way, but I can make it into something that I actually embrace, that I actually see is one of the richest places for me to work. And hopefully none of us are falsely convicted and spend 30 years on death row. Hopefully none of us ever have to go through anything as horrible as the concentration camps in Nazi Germany. But we all have our own challenges. We all have our own things that are our grist for the mill. So when we talk about these eight worldly concerns, we're really just beginning to understand these polar responses that we have, and the fact that every time, you know, we go grasping at needing it our way, needing all these things that we have on that list, and then the aversion that comes up when we don't get that, we're strengthening patterns that aren't allowing us to grow. They aren't allowing us to achieve our full potential. They're actually blocks to that. So that's why transforming problems, this whole technique that's taught in Lojong, is so powerful. It's because it's taking that very stuff and transmuting it. There's that wonderful analogy that's used for kind of the mind, where we are recognizing that the suffering of life is something we actually need to use on the path, and it's the idea of a lotus. If you've ever seen lotuses grow out in nature, they come up from the muckiest, muddiest part of the water. And so they take all that stuff that's like the place in the water where you wouldn't want to go, you wouldn't want to swim, you wouldn't want to hang out there. And from all of that muck, they grow and they rise up above it and blossom. In fact, there was this wonderful title that Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese Zen Buddhist master, gave to one of his books that I'm so jealous of, because I think it's such an amazing title for a course. No mud, no lotus. You know, and that's how we can think about Lojong and think about what we're trying to do here. We have this strong aversion to having those things in our life, but without those things in our life, we don't get the lotus. We don't get that full flowering of enlightenment. We don't get to experience what it's like to achieve our true potential. So this is the promise that these things have for us, if we're actually willing to go through those two steps that Rinpoche encourages us to do. To first, stop having such a strong aversion to things that aren't going the way you want them to go, what we call our problems, our difficulties, our suffering. And then begin to frame them in the, it's like, oh, wow, I actually even get to work with this. How wonderful. You know, I get excited about it. I've got a problem in my life. How wonderful. Now, again, you're not going to say that to your friends when they say, oh, I've got a really bad problem. You go, oh, how wonderful for you. They'll probably look at you like, oh, my God, what are you so we have to, you know, this is a, these teachings, actually, the entire corpus of what's come to be known as Lojong, actually was taught in secret. There's these wonderful stories of Geshe Chikawa, who was one of these great Tibetan masters who came after Lama Atisha. Lama Atisha came to Tibet from India, as I said, about 1,000 years ago, and he started this whole lineage of what has come to be known the Kadampa tradition. Hence, you know, Kadampa Center here. The Kadampa tradition are these folks who were all trained by Lama Atisha and his followers, particularly Drom Tompa, who was his main Tibetan disciple, to practice in this way. But they kept it very secret, because it's pretty outrageous to practice this way. It's not what we practice in the world, right? You know, yet we do see some examples of it. We do see some amazing, courageous stories of people who are confronted with these things, like Dr. Edith Eva Eggert, like, you know, Anthony Ray Hinton, that we can say, oh, wow, these guys get it. They didn't need all the Buddhist teachings to get it. Maybe they got them in another lifetime, and that's why they're able to practice them. But we know that we have the possibility of doing that. Every one of us can do that. So this is quite kind of the exciting thing about Lojong, is that we're taking something that was really quite secretive, and it's now out in the world. It's now something that every one of us can practice. But it's not for the faint-hearted, not for the person who's weak in courage or whatever. We have to have a lot of courage to practice this way. So one story that kind of exemplifies the effect and the power of these is, it said that Geshe Chikawa had a brother who was actually a pretty hard-minded guy, apparently. He didn't really, you know, it was pretty awful to be around and everything. And Geshe Chikawa would be teaching his disciples in secret, but, you know, his brother apparently on the other side, was like on the other side of the wall or whatever, and listening to these teachings. And he actually started, Geshe Chikawa started to notice his brother changing, that his brother was softening. He was becoming a different person. And he recognized that the teachings didn't need to be secret any longer, because if they could have this amazing effect on his hard-minded brother, who he thought could never change, then they could have an incredible effect on so many others. Geshe Chikawa from there wrote what's called the 7-point mind training, which encapsulates a lot of these ideas. One of the points is to transform adversities, difficulties, into the path. Again, there are many other aspects of Lojong. The main one that's focused on in this module is this idea of transforming those things we call problems and difficulties into the path. So these teachings have incredible power. They have an ability to really help us to confront those things that we find difficult, to embrace the possibility within that of transforming our heart completely, and by virtue of that, attain enlightenment. So the one thing I always admonish people when we start a subject like this in terms of transforming problems into happiness is don't think that this essentially means that you're going to get rid of problems. What those things that are on the list over here, those four things are still going to keep happening. And that shouldn't be the measure of whether we're practicing well. As I said, His Holiness says if we get all four things that we want when things are going well, we tend to diminish the strength of our practice and think, oh, we must be doing pretty good. I'm not bad as a Buddhist practitioner because it's all going quite well. In fact, I'll tell you a little story. When Venerable Robina, who I cite frequently because she's one of my main teachers, she was teaching at our center in San Francisco before I went off to study at Instituto Lama Tsongkhapa for the master's program. It's a 7-year program, and I was essentially having to pack up my whole life and exit everything. I'd been in San Francisco for like 18, 19 years. And the night I came in for the teaching, she said, so sit down, Don, and tell me, how's it going and how are things happening with your getting ready to go to the master's program? And I just started rattling off how, oh, everything's going really quite well, and and work is wrapping up nicely, and home is gone, and all these things are happening. And then she looked at me and she said, well, Don, if things are going that well, either you're already a Buddha or you're not practicing hard enough. And I was like, okay. Sorry. But we can become kind of full of ourselves when things are going well, and so then we don't really take for granted that there's more work to do. So the point I'm making here is that we have to be able to kind of get out of this sort of intoxication that we have with needing things to be our way and then getting bent out of shape when they aren't, and recognize that there's a greater potential that we have to work with that. So maybe at this point, it's 8:15, I can open it up to a few questions and see if there's some questions that people might have. Yes, Guillermo, right? Yes. Yeah.
Thank you, Don. My question or reflection is if happiness exists or suffering exists, because in order to experience happiness, you need to suffer, and vice versa, no?
Right.
So it's difficult to understand happiness without suffering.
Right.
And without suffering without happiness.
Yeah, they're quite relative.
Therefore, doesn't exist happiness by itself and suffering by itself, so it's an illusion, happiness and suffering?
It's a very good question. Is it an illusion? Well, everything is sort of like an illusion. Everything has that illusory quality. When we start talking about things that are relative in our conventional world, which happiness and suffering are, or pleasure and pain, let's use those words, because of the relativity of that, it's very hard to define exactly that something is set in one category. Nonetheless, we do identify conventionally what we call suffering, which is those things that induce that unpleasant feeling, and then what we call happiness or pleasure, the experience that we have when we register that type of feeling. So we have these two things that are going on in terms of our experience that are relative to each other. I use the example of kind of like coming in and out of the house. I've always wanted to try this. I talk about this. I've never actually done it. But say you took one hand and you put it in a bowl of ice water, and another hand and you put it in like a heating pad, and you had in front of you just a bowl of lukewarm water, right? So you've got one hand that's freezing, one hand that's really quite warm. Put both hands into the water that's lukewarm. And you're going to feel like this contrasting thing. For one hand, it feels like it's quite cold because it's been in a heating pad. For the other hand, it's going to feel quite warm because it's been in ice water. Well, are you experiencing suffering or happiness at that time? You know, you're kind of experiencing both. But it's all relative because the water itself is only one temperature. You know? It's all quite relative to where you're at and what's going on, what precedes it even in a sense. And so this is a bit of what's registering for us, is that oftentimes we're experiencing what is unpleasant in relation to having gotten used to what is pleasant. And then we like this feeling of the pleasantness in relation to what we just were experiencing that was unpleasant. And so is there some absolutism about this? No, we can see that actually it's all quite relative. Now, what does it mean then to, if we start talking about these goals like liberation or enlightenment, what happens at that point where you have a mind that is no longer conditioned in that way to kind of have that experience that's sort of karmically determined in one way or another? They talk about Buddhahood, for example, being very blissful, but I don't think it's the kind of conditioned relative thing that we're talking about in our experience. I think we're talking about a state of this transcendent mind that has really gotten beyond all of that kind of conditionality. And that's the bliss. That's the real freedom that can occur. So as long as we're in this conditioned world, we're going to be conditioned to have these different types of experiences that register as these four things we find pleasant and the four things we find unpleasant. And that's just the way it is. That's just going to continue to happen. And there's debates, I think. There was one woman from the Zen tradition who came to my classes, still comes to my classes sometimes, who argued that even a Buddha would experience what we call pain and pleasure and the contrast of that, but wouldn't have any subsequent suffering on the basis of that because their mind's not going to get all caught up. Well, but then is it really pain? You know, pain and pleasure are something relative to this conditioned existence. There's something that we're experiencing on the basis of our karmic conditioning that we find particular things pleasant, particularly things unpleasant. Because as I pointed out, and as we all recall, there's nothing inherently there that makes it pleasant. There's nothing inherently over here that makes it unpleasant. I mean, look, somebody told me about these people who participate in, it's a gender bias title for this, Iron Man competitions, because it should be Iron Person, I suppose, because I think women participate. Have you heard of the Iron Man competition? I mean, pretty outrageous stuff. I'm sorry, you know. Don't sign me up for that. I mean, they go through unbelievable, what we would call pain. There was a memoir of somebody who'd gone through this that a friend of mine told me he'd read. And this guy did 10 in a row. And he said, towards the end of one, he had broken a leg, and he's like continuing to do this competition with a broken leg. And you're like, my gosh, you know, so here's somebody who has gone through what is a painful experience for almost everybody on the planet. And it was probably inducing endorphins in this guy. You know, he was getting more and more excited about what he needed to do to compete. I mean, it's pretty outrageous. Or even the training that goes into all of that. Look at the training that Olympic athletes do. You know, it would be torture and punishment for many of us to do those sorts of things. But they're, because of the mind state that they have, the way that they're looking at it, it's something that they actually enjoy. So, back to, does that kind of give you some context for, I don't have an absolute answer for that, but I think that's how I have to see it, simply based on my understanding of how we are karmically having these experiences. There's nothing set that makes that pleasant. There's nothing set that makes that unpleasant. It's simply conditioned for us to experience those things in that way. And we can all conventionally agree to what we call comfort or discomfort, but when it comes to the actual elements of it, it's really quite different. Or even material wealth and loss, you know. And some people get really bent out of shape if they lose a quarter, you know. Some people won't really feel it if they lose a whole home to a fire. They'll be like, oh, that's okay. Right? You know, they have that lack of attachment to those things. So, I don't know. Interesting. Any other questions? Sure, Anne.
Is Lojong an umbrella and there's different texts that go along with it, or?
Well, sometimes Lojong is sort of called a genre of teachings. It's sort of a category of teachings that are all falling into this category of ways of working with our minds in regard to whatever we're experiencing to try to strengthen, in particular our bodhicitta, in particular our wish to become enlightened. They're taught in the Mahayana as in that context. And so there actually is a wonderful volume. You may have it in the library. You might even have it in the bookstore. It was published by a branch of Wisdom Publications called the Tibetan Classics or Institute of Tibet. I can't remember the exact Library of Tibetan Classics. Thupten Jinpa is behind all of this. And it's the mind training collection. It's got like all of the traditional mind training texts in it, including the one that you're going to study as part of this course. So you're going to mainly use Transforming Problems into Happiness by Lama Zopa Rinpoche. And in conjunction with that, this amazing text called The 8 Verses of Thought Transformation that was written by Geshe Langri Tangpa, who actually was one of these initial Kadampa masters. His story is quite interesting too, and the ways that he was able to transform things in his life. But so this whole genre of teachings that we call Lojong includes within it, because if we talk about like the 7-point mind training that Geshe Chikawa taught, it's I think the fourth one that is, the third point is transforming adverse situations into the path. So it's not the full corpus of Lojong, but it's the main one that we emphasize in this tradition simply because it's really the most powerful one that we can work with in terms of our daily lives that have many problems in them, have many difficulties in them. It's rich stuff. Another analogy for this in our everyday world is the way we use manure as fertilizer, right? You know, it's some of the richest stuff. You know, we don't want to kind of take a bath in it, but it is the stuff that, you know, things grow from. Well, this is like the manure of our lives that we want to make into really rich fertilizer. We want to allow it to help to grow our spiritual realizations, our spiritual practice. So all of Lojong is this bigger umbrella. It includes Tonglen, the practice of giving and taking that you all studied in a couple of modules ago in Module 10. It includes even we could say some of the main Lam Rim teachings are included because they are part of training our mind to be able to practice it this way. That's actually the first of the 7 points, train in the preliminaries. So this isn't the sort of thing that you just jump into the deep end with, you know, because this is the deep end of the pool. It's good to work with the trainings, the teachings that precede this, to be better qualified to work with them and understand all the dynamics of them, because they're very much rooted in concepts like karma. Yeah. Karma is one of the main points that we keep going back to understand that what we do have that are these four things that bring us some unpleasant experience, we've karmically created those in our lives. Therefore, they're exactly tailored for us. The problem in your life was just handmade for you, and no one else handmade it for you. You handmade it for you. You know, so welcome. You know, this is what I've created. What can I learn from this? How can I develop my heart on the basis of this? That's what we mean by transforming problems into happiness. But yeah, the bigger body is Lojong, and transforming problems, we would say, is a subset of that. Any other questions, Aaron, on that? Or no?
No.
Okay. Yeah. How about anyone else in the room? We have maybe a couple more minutes. Yes, Laurie.
So I was thinking about the transforming the negative situations, like, for instance, the music you were talking about.
Right.
So I find that in my case, my husband likes that loud music. And so I tend to, like, I don't get upset about it, but I'll move to a different room where I can't hear it, or I do something that takes me kind of away from it.
Right.
Is that the wrong thing to do? Well, am I supposed to, like, somehow...
Yeah.
Make it where I almost like the music.
That's an excellent question, Laurie. I'm so glad you brought that up, because when I said, you know, like, kind of this is higher level practice, it doesn't mean that everything that precedes it is not good practice.
Okay.
I always talk about the first defense in terms of working with our minds is get the heck away from the things that trigger us. You know, that's, His Holiness even said, like, if you're in a dangerous situation, his idea is run away. You know, that's the best thing. You know, get out of there. So if we're in a situation where something is triggering us, there's that music or that, you know, whatever, our first response, if we're just baby practitioners, and I'm not meaning that in a derogatory way, I mean, we have to train our minds. That's what we're talking about here, a gradual process of training our minds. Then we recognize that sometimes our first step is to say, thank you very much, but I need to get away from that because I know if I stay in the presence of that, it's going to trigger me to do all kinds of things. Before I know it, I'm going to be ready to, you know, strangle the person who's playing that music. Maybe you won't strangle your husband, but hopefully not. But people do strangle their partners, you know. So that's a really good first line of defense. And then as you, it's not that you just do that all the time then, because we know we can't do that. Those four things are going to be in our lives. We're going to have uncomfortable situations, some that we can't get away from. So we have to train our minds on the cushion to develop the skills and abilities to be able to transform that, to work with that in greater degrees. And so some techniques to work with that are to cultivate the opposite of what we have at that time, you know, to try to, when we have a strong aversion, to try to work with generating some kind of loving kindness in the midst of that. And that's a very powerful technique. And then we have techniques where we realize emptiness at the time, which is a very profound teaching that you all had in the last module. If you can apply those, that's great. And what we're talking about with transforming problems is another level of working with that situation. And none of these are wrong. All of them are simply where we're at and what we find a useful tool to use. We're kind of like, you know, a superhero with our utility belt, you know, and we take out the thing that kind of we need at the moment. So if I need right now, you know, to be separated from it, well, then that's what I do.
Okay.
Does that make some sense?
Yeah. So is the goal to eventually not have a response of negativity toward the music or the cold or the hot? Is that...
I would say that, yeah, if we can get a mind that is sort of calmly dealing with whatever is going on. I mean, there's these stories, the ones I've mentioned, I mean, they're mirrored in Tibet by many of the prisons that are in Tibet still, run by the Chinese, and these stories of men and women who were imprisoned and come out with these amazing tales of how they were able to transform pretty awful conditions. I mean, worse than the prisons we have in the U.S. in terms of torture and all sorts of stuff happening to people, rape, you know, unbelievable things. And some of them came out and said their biggest challenge was maintaining their compassion in the midst of all of that. You know, that shows a pretty strong mind, that their biggest challenge wasn't getting angry in the midst of all that. Their biggest challenge was being able to hold on to the compassion for their captors, mm-hmm. for their torturers. So if we can get to a place where we're filled with all the positive qualities, recall that essentially the Buddha's teachings are to help us to do those two things, to completely remove everything that is negative. This is embodied in the Tibetan word for Buddha, the first part of it. Sang, to completely purify our minds and get rid of all those negative tendencies, and Gye, to completely develop everything that is positive. Sangye is the word that is in Tibetan that encapsulates what it means to be a Buddha. So if you attain, you know, even just a measure of that, to where you can abide in some sort of peaceful state where you're not being triggered to have a negative emotion, and in the midst of what's going on, it's only positive thoughts. It's only compassion. It's only loving kindness. That's already pretty amazing. If you can get to Buddhahood where that is all that you'll have, because all that other stuff's gone. You've completely purified it. And you've completely developed all those positive qualities. And every one of us has the potential for that. And that's the important thing to remember. That's what I was emphasizing even yesterday, that we all have Buddha nature. Without a doubt, there's no need to despair. There's no need to be pessimistic. Because in the end, we all have that potential to achieve enlightenment, and the Buddha says in the end, we all will achieve that enlightenment. But it doesn't just happen.
Yeah,
you know, just like you don't, you know, get a good career by just saying, oh, I'm going to go work there. You know, you have to do everything that's necessary for you to be qualified to do that. So it's the same thing for Buddhahood.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Laurie. Thank you for bringing up that question. These questions are great because they do touch on things that I should have taught. So it's quite useful to get questions like these. So it's just after 8:30. Let's go ahead and conclude tonight. If there's no other questions, I'll hang out for a little bit, a couple minutes, if people would like to ask any questions, if you weren't comfortable with that in the group context. But let's go to the prayer book and just recite a couple of prayers that are useful at the end of this. Let's go to page 235, and we're just going to do these two prayers, and then I'm going to give you a couple additional thoughts, you know, that you might accompany this with. Page 235, we have what we call our dedication prayers, and we're going to recite the first one, which is where we kind of think that, you know, we've all planted some really amazing positive seeds. Whatever thoughts you've had during this last hour and a half, I'm sure some of them were virtuous, some of them were good, some of them were positive. You know, something that hopefully you thought of on the basis of the words I've shared, you know, that you can say, yes, I want to nurture that seed. I want that seed to ripen into the most amazing benefit for myself and others. And that's essentially what we're doing in that first verse, is sort of protecting that, making sure that that brings forth the best results, all those seeds that we planted, however many. And then in the second verse, we recall that mind of bodhicitta that we discussed a bit at the beginning, that we meditated on, this mind of awakening, this idea that we can become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings. And we make that strong aspiration that we're able to grow and develop that mind to a limitless degree, and that others may also cultivate this mind in their hearts. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. Then make just in your own mind, make a prayer for the good health and long lives of spiritual teachers. And we usually think about His Holiness Dalai Lama, you know, the head of the Tibetan Buddhist religion and culture. We want strong prayers for him to continue to be in this world, because we need these kinds of examples and we need their guiding influence. We can think about all the other teachers that we have in this tradition, teachers in other traditions, people who are dedicated to helping others to develop their hearts, to develop compassion and kindness and wisdom and so on. And just make that strong prayer that through what we've done here tonight, may these beings who are guiding us continue to be in this world, and may we and others always have perfect guides in our lives. And then finally, just dedicate for anyone personally whose situation moves you. So maybe you know people or individuals who are experiencing some obstacles to their well-being, who are ill, who are dying, or who have died. And just send this positive energy out to them. Just kind of gladly give it to them, thinking it becomes the cause for them to be free from their difficulties, for them to know true peace and happiness. Okay, thank you all very much. I enjoyed this. And good luck with the module. I hope you're able to participate in the whole module, because this is one of the best, really. This is an amazing, amazing course. So
I've got just a couple words. I'm Donna Cease. I'm Spiritual Programs Coordinator at Kanapa Center, and want to let you know about two big things coming up this week. Next Sunday is when our resident teacher, Geshe Gelug, will be returning from his break. He's been away for a little bit more than 3 months, so we'll be welcoming him back next Sunday morning at 10:30 here. Also, Aaron mentioned at the beginning that this class won't be meeting next Monday because it is a Buddha holy day. And if you are interested in, if you don't have yet and are interested in beginning to do a practice that's very powerful, it's called taking the 8 Mahayana precepts. And the first time, this is a practice where you take some vows that you just follow for a day, no killing, no stealing, etc. And there's a lot of power in living in vows even for a short amount of time. And the very first time you take the precepts, it needs to be taken with a qualified master. And our teachers very kindly will usually offer this on a Buddha holy day, but you need to register for it. So if you're interested in doing it, it's going to happen first thing in the morning, very early in the morning. if you're interested in doing this, then go to our website and look for next Monday, July 16. First thing on there is the 8 Mahayana Precepts, and if you open that up, then you'll get a link to register for it. And last, I'd like to introduce our director, Robbie Watkins, and he's got a few words to say to Don and the rest of us.
Hey, Don. Okay.